Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is knowledge and product editor Sarah Davidson. And it's all about heroes and villains. Can the great vampire squid, that is Goldman Sachs, persuade UK savers to join its cuddly new savings bank, Marcus? The pariah of the housing market's taken some blows of late, but is buy-to-let really out for the count? Plus, do you know who's snooping on your social media account? And, well, it's not all bad news, as the police ride to the rescue of hundreds of millions of pounds worth of perfectly good cars, including Ferraris and Lamborghinis. All this and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, the villain of the first-time buyer piece, buy-to-let, has suffered a bit of a hammering over the past few years. A succession of government and Bank of England crackdowns has left the sector reeling and many landlords pulling out altogether. But don't write off buy-to-let just yet, we're being told, Sarah.
Yeah, absolutely. We spoke to a fund manager called Alan Collett last week, whose fund invests in residential property, rental property, and he's still absolutely backing the sector. And in fact, if you speak to mortgage lenders and mortgage brokers as well, the landlords aren't necessarily exiting the market in the droves that it might seem like they are. Those who've maybe got one property or have become an accidental landlord, those are the people who are thinking, you know what, this is too much hassle now, it's too expensive, it's not worth it. But the professional landlords are still very much in the game and are snapping up those bargains. It's just about knowing what kind of property and where to buy.
Simon? Bit more context, why would people be leaving the buy-to-let market at the moment? I've said government and Bank of England crackdowns. Give us an overview of what the industry is looking like, how it's changed over recent years, and so why people might be suggesting it's dead.
Well, I would say that there are a handful of major things that are affecting the property investment market. The first of which is if you are going to buy a property as a buy-to-let investment, you now have to pay a 3% stamp duty surcharge, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's the difference between £2,500 and £10,000 on an average UK home. And that's a big extra barrier to entry, particularly when you consider that a lot of the buy-to-let boom was driven by ordinary people come into some money or had some savings and decided that property was the best place to invest it. Now, you've got to raise a deposit to buy that property. The deposits on buy-to-let mortgages are larger than on traditional mortgages. And if you've then got to go out and find another £10,000, that is a substantial barrier to entry, particularly if the deposit you're putting down is £50,000, for example. Then, for people who are already existing landlords, there is a tax change that is being slowly staged in, and it involves the income tax that you must pay on the rent that you take in. Now, previously, you could offset all of your mortgage interest against your rental income, and then you took the figure in the middle, which was your profit, and you paid tax on that at your tax rate. The way that this is being changed is that you will soon only be able to get a 20% basic rate tax credit on your mortgage interest. But there's a crucial difference as well, because your rental income will be added to your other income to decide your tax rate. You'll be taxed on that, and then you get the tax credit against the mortgage. Mm. So for people who aren't basic rate taxpayers, which if you think about the fact that probably most buy-to-let landlords are going to be wealthier, and actually the fact that the rental income can push you up a tax bracket, it makes a big difference. And where it makes a big difference is for those people who perhaps have big mortgages and aren't making that much money each month on the rent, but thought that it was worth holding on to because they thought house prices would keep going up. And also the accidental landlord, the people who decided to hold on to a property. It's a couple. You have a couple who both owned a property each. They decide they're going to move in together. They move into one, or they try to buy a bigger house and they try to hold on to one property.
There's lots of reasons why.
The classic moving out of London thing. You have the flat in London. It's gone up in value so much. You can remortgage, take some money out of it. You can buy your new place. Or even actually the people it's really hurting. And actually, I think that it'd be good for the government to try and work out some way of helping these people, is the people who actually can't sell their home and decide that they want to let it out and rent another one to live in. that's not very tax efficient, you know, from now on. This is being phased in and people are just starting to feel the squeeze and think it's maybe not worth doing it. Then the other factor that comes into it is regulation. There's considerably more regulation going on, both in terms of how the mortgage market is regulated and landlords themselves, the things that they have to do. And the final thing is the fact that houses are expensive. They are more expensive in some parts of the country than they are in others. But if you break down property prices and measure them against wages, local wages, in every part of the country, houses are expensive. And generally, if you want to turn a profit on something, it's better to buy it than when it's cheap than when it's expensive.
Sarah, why was all this brought in? I assume it's to help first-time buyers, but what's the sort of knock-on impact been on them? And I suppose also those people who are renting, which will be first-time buyers, presumably before they actually buy.
Yeah, that's exactly the knock-on effect. It was brought in under the previous Conservative government when George Osborne was Chancellor. And it was part of their big play to win some younger voters back from the Jeremy Corbyn fan club. And in doing what they did, basically saying, we're going to crack down on landlords because they are taking away the same properties that first-time buyers should be buying, which is up for debate as it is. But, you know, that's what they said. Mm. We're going to make it harder for landlords to stay in business profitably so that they sell these properties back onto the market and then first-time buyers can buy them. There are a few errors in that argument. The Help to Buy scheme, for example, which is designed to top up first-time buyers' deposits, only now applies to new build property. And it's not actually just for first-time buyers. You can also access it if you're moving house. But you have to be buying a new home.
Which has arguably pushed up the premium of new build homes.
Absolutely. But it doesn't help, you know, that flood of properties back onto the market, if they're still expensive, it doesn't help first-time buyers access them, particularly unless they've already got over that hurdle of saving for their deposit. The other thing is that the more pressure you put on landlords' profits, the more that they're going to adjust their commercials in order to pay for that, which means that rents have gone up. And it is, as you point out, first-time buyer or would-be first-time buyers who are renting. And so a lot more of their disposable income is being eaten up with housing costs, not going towards building up capital equity in a property. It means that they can save less, they're having to save for longer, and in the meantime, house prices are still going up.
So, Simon, we need landlords. We need the buy-to-let market. There's no question about it. And actually, you've, as Sarah pointed out, been speaking to someone who says, look, it's not dead, it's just changed. So how can you, if you still want to, get involved in this area? Where's the money to be found? What about if interest rate rise? What are all the things you need to consider if you do want to get involved?
Well, firstly, it's worth noting that despite these changes, actually landlords do still have a considerable advantage over first-time buyers. And this is what some of these tax changes were aimed at trying to erode. Because the fact of the matter is that landlords can not only offset all of their mortgage interest against their rental income, and it is not possible for homeowners to offset their mortgage interest against their tax bill, and hasn't been for many, many years. But also, landlords buy with interest-only mortgages, and that's common, whereas it's very difficult to get an interest-only mortgage as a residential home buyer at the moment. And to put that into context, if you buy a £225,000 property with a £175,000 mortgage, as an owner-occupier, you're going to have to take a residential mortgage. You will be paying £704 a month because you're repaying the mortgage as well, which is a good thing. As a landlord, however, who is seeking to profit from the rent, you will only be paying £277 a month. So there's a big gap there. Obviously, you've both still got to find the deposit. Landlords tend to put down slightly bigger deposits than homeowners, and it is harder for them to get small deposit mortgages. But once you've got that deposit, what are you going to do? Well, ideally, what you want to be doing is you want to be looking for a place where you can find a good tenant, and the house that or flat that you are buying matches the kind of people who want to rent a house or flat. That seems like really basic stuff, doesn't it? But you wouldn't believe the amount of people who go into buy-to-let without properly considering it and end up buying unsuitable properties for their target tenant. I do think that it is true that landlords end up buying pretty much the same properties as first-time buyers. Most commonly, they'll buy flats or small houses. those are the most common first-time buyer properties. Those are the easiest ones to get into. You could go out and buy a bigger property, a larger family home, but you start to find that it's less likely that you're going to find people or a wide pool of people who want to rent it, because the further up the chain you go, the more people are likely to be home buyers. But if you do decide to do that, you need to go for a good property, keep it well maintained, keep it neutral, make it that people will walk in there and go, I want to rent this place. Because actually, if you can make your property stand out as a landlord, as a nice place to rent, you are already in probably the top,
so
top 10% of properties for rent. Because anybody who has ever rented a property knows that when you start looking down the listings or going around properties, there's some real dogs out there that just aren't taken care of. And that is not just in London and the major cities. Even if you look at family homes in normal places, you can see that there's often been less care, love and attention and care put on them. And one of the great pieces of advice in this article is, a good home finds a good tenant.
Yeah.
And the key to good returns from buy to let is to keep your tenants happy, because if you keep your tenants happy, then they don't leave. And it's when your tenants leave,
and
you end up with your home not rented for a couple of months and 2 months worth of void periods whilst you're paying the mortgage and all the other bills, that really dent your profits. So it's a long-term game. You buy the property, you want to rent it out, ideally for as long as possible. You raise rents in a sensible fashion, you keep your tenants happy, and over the years you make your money. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme anymore.
But still worth it?
Well, it all depends on whether you think that you're going to get enough of an income-based return from your investment to justify the fact that you're probably not going to see the same big capital gains in years to come, and that house prices might fall. And that when house prices are going up, because buy-to-let tends to be a leveraged investment, you put in some money and then you borrow a load more, you make lots of money compared to the deposit you put in. But when house prices fall, you'll lose money faster.
And I can't believe you got through that without saying the B word. And then also we've got sort of the Labour government issue going on. Threats, perhaps, to the sector still to be faced?
Well, if we see a general election post-Brexit, if there's no deal, which Labour has called for yesterday.
Great, because we love an election.
And we love an election in this country.
Not enough, I don't think.
We're not fed up of them at all. If we were to see that, if we were to see Labour get into power, yes, landlords would be facing yet more change, certainly. Mm. Corbyn has said on previous occasions that he would like to see rental increase caps brought in, secure tenancies, long-term tenancies. He said that he wants to scrap Section 21, which is the ability for landlords to evict tenants who haven't paid after a specific period of time. I think it's 6 months. That is one of the kind of holy grails of buy-to-let law at the moment, because if you've got a problem tenant in your property and they've not paid their rent for 6 months, there are already significant protections available to tenants, but it can absolutely destroy the value of your property. And it's likely, if they're not paying rent, that they're probably not looking after the property either. And then once you finally do get them out, you've got all of that refurbishment cost to face.
So if anyone was persuaded by what Simon said, they've now changed their mind because of potentially.
Well, I think it's worth looking at the Scottish property market in terms of what Corbyn's suggesting, because Scotland has actually brought in a lot of those changes to the law already. True. They've been in place for the past year, I think. And actually, there's not been a huge amount of change in that rental market. It's still a very popular place for landlords to invest. So they've obviously not been put off by it. I have spoken to lenders in the past who are a bit more wary. Probably you'd need a bigger deposit than you used to 3 or 4 years ago to protect the lender's interest. But at the moment, those changes haven't really dented demand to invest in buy-to-let.
Well, that's interesting. You talk about looking at Scotland. What about elsewhere in the country? Because the next piece of research might be quite interesting, Simon, for buy-to-letters. About where in the country new homes are being built. You've got an article on your website that looks at exactly this issue. So while lots of people might be thinking, God, I can't get to school, the traffic's so bad, it feels like there's pressure on services, no one can get around. Actually, it may be nothing to do with new buildings and the like. So, Simon, where in the country are new houses being built?
Well, you can look at this in terms of the number of properties being built, mm-hmm. or you can look at it in terms of the number of properties being built as a percentage increase compared to them. And there's a very interesting answer to this, because if you tend to think about newly built properties, and you tend to think of when you go outside of London and outside of the city. Mm-hmm. And I certainly noticed this. I was up in sort of North Hertfordshire stroke Cambridgeshire stroke Bedfordshire area, that kind of triangle, the other day. And there was loads of houses being thrown up. I've driven past Bicester. There's loads of houses being thrown up near there, up into the Midlands. But actually, the answer, according to this research, which came from the Royal Mail, was Tower Hamlets in London, with a 14% increase. That was followed by Corby with 11%, Cambridge with 11%, although I suspect that that is not in Cambridge itself, that is the area around Cambridge, and Uttlesford with 11%, and then Dartford as well, again, the outskirts of London once you start going out.
How many are we talking about for some of these? What type of houses are being built? Because I imagine in Tower Hamlets it's not going to be big four-bedroom types.
Well, no, it's going to be flats in Tower Hamlets. Percentage of growth between 2010 to 2017, 14%. Now, that might have slowed now, obviously, mm-hmm. due to the slight issues in the London property market. Corby, though, in the Midlands, 11%. So that's 11% percentage of growth. Cambridge, 11%.
What are you talking about, though? Like 2,000, 10,000, 50,000? Well, it wouldn't be that many, would it?
The figure answers change around a bit, but for Tower Hamlets, between 2010 and 2017, the number of homes increased by 14,500.
So I'm asking that just more for the fact of, talked earlier about pressure on services. You know, it's all very well building 14,000 new homes in an area, but if you're not going to also build accompanying schools, GP surgeries, hospitals at the same time, road networks, etc., are we getting those built as well? Is there any information around that?
There isn't in here, but this is why you will find that actually once you start going by numbers, a lot of the places aren't in the packed southeast of England. Yeah. They are. You've got the top one is actually Cornwall, 17,450. Wiltshire, 14,230. Leeds, 14,180. Birmingham, 11,270. And so on. And this is a genuine issue, certainly for those people who are living in areas in the London commuter belt, the southeast, where the hospitals have closed, the trains are full, there's not enough school places, and then they're being told that their town has to plan for another few thousand homes. The answer is, we don't want another few thousand homes.
Yeah. Unless
you build another hospital, unless you build a school. And there's always promises of these things. Interestingly, there's rarely a promise of a hospital. But it's the trains as well. It's the roads. It's the things like that. And I think that we will forever struggle to convince people of that. And also, there's a lot of people saying in these areas that they think their town is big enough. And I don't think that's necessarily NIMBYism, because if you live somewhere, you want to protect the character of that place. And there is an argument that part of the character of certain towns and certain places is that they are only a certain size. Mm. And if you start allowing them to sprawl bigger, then they lose some of that character. So that's why I think some of the ideas about actually building new settlements or new towns are quite good, because you take an area and then you put a new place there, but it has to be connected to all the others, and it needs hospitals and schools and things like that.
All right, well, we'll leave housing villains to one side. It wouldn't be a heroes and villains show without talking about banking, would it? They don't come much bigger or scarier than Goldman Sachs, dubbed the Great Vampire Squid by Rolling Stone magazine during the financial crisis. Can the mighty US bank shake off its old image and become a hero for UK savers? Now, Simon, we've spoken about Marcus on podcast past, and now Marcus has come riding to town this week to, a little bit of fanfare. It's got a table-topping 1.5%. Give us some context, would you, Simon, about a little bit about Goldman Sachs. What is Marcus? What the heck am I talking about?
Marcus is a so-called challenger bank, but it is also one of those challenger banks that challenges the concept of the challenger
right,
bank.
Right, yes, we spoke about that as well.
It happens to be one of the world's largest banks, just operating under a slightly different name. And that name is Marcus. And that name, Marcus, relates to one of its founders, Marcus Goldman. Mm-hmm. And they are moving in to UK consumer banking. And they have ridden in, as you said, clutching a banner marked 1.5% savings account. Had you ridden in to town clutching that banner before the financial crisis that arguably Goldman Sachs was definitely involved in triggering, you would have been laughed out of town. But now 1.5% savings account is market leading, and already others are upping their rates.
Well, that's what I was gonna
in
ask
response.
You. Yeah.
I think Goldman Sachs missed a
trick. And this is not the first time they've done this. They're doing it in America already, aren't they?
They've done this in America. It's been successful there. Yeah. And if you are Goldman Sachs and you are going to launch a bank, it makes sense to do it with a big bang. Don't come sidling in with some rate that's just around about the others or below the others. Come in with a big bang. And it includes a bonus. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, apparently, that when that bonus falls off in a year's time, all you have to do is go onto the website, into your online banking, and press a button, and you'll get the bonus for another year.
It's 0.15%, isn't it?
0.15%, yeah. So that's pretty good. I mean, I think they missed a trick. I think that they should have called their new bank Vampire Squid. But you know,
yeah, I just...
That's
not quite
why I don't work
as,
in the marketing department.
As Marcus, although Marcus sort of sounds...
But maybe it would have been funny. Maybe it would have been... It might have appealed to, you know, the contrarians out there.
Yeah, maybe.
A certain cachet.
It could appeal
that.
For, you know, young people might like that sort of thing. But for anyone who doesn't actually know the context, it might be a bit confusing. But is the money not going back to Goldman Sachs? So look, if you do have sort of a moral issue with it, this is not the account for you, as good as the rate may or may not be. Do you think that'll impact anyone's decisions?
No, they're going to hand over all the profits to widows and orphans.
Because that's how the system works, right?
Yeah, well, of course the profits are going back to Goldman Sachs, yes. And this is why when you're thinking about challenger banks and if you want to challenge the existing banking system by signing up to a challenger bank, you might want to think about who that challenger bank is. If you decide that part of your reason for choosing a small, plucky little bank fighting the system is because you like small, plucky little banks fighting the system, the Marcus account is probably not for you. If you choose them because you just want the highest possible savings rate and actually you don't really care about all that stuff, then it's the Vampire Squid Bank all the way.
Sarah?
It'll be interesting to see what else they do in the future. A lot of the challenger banks have started off with a savings account and have come in with a bang. Look at Atom. Mm. And traditionally, the model, the banking model, is you bring retail savings in on one side of the balance sheet and you lend that money out on mortgages on the other side. And Goldman Sachs has a history of lending mortgages in the UK market under various different brands. It did that in the early 2000s before everything went pop. So if they are considering doing that again, that could be very good news for people who want to buy houses, having another player in the market. I think the other thing is that if you're, as Simon says, if you're going to choose a challenger bank, are you going there for the rate or are you going there for the fact that it's a challenger? And a lot of the challengers at the top of the tables are Sharia compliant banks now. They have tended to be the most competitive on the market, and that's because they don't offer a guaranteed rate of interest in the same way as UK banks do. They offer expected rate of return, and that's because they actually invest the money because of Sharia law.
Yeah.
So some British savers have been slightly more nervous about that because there is an element of risk in putting your money into that. So this offers a real alternative to that in a more traditional type of account. So
would you be put off though by the big bank Goldman, or is, you know,
look, I mean, all the banks have done bad things in the past. So for me personally, no, I would say it's a challenger brand with the security of a really big bank sitting behind it, and that actually, if I'm going to put my money in, that's a good thing from my perspective. I think there's a slightly strange dichotomy going on there because you've got the challenger brands, which are tend to appeal to the younger audience, really, but then the savings rates tend to appeal to an older audience who don't like online as much, as a general rule, as the younger generation. So how that plays out, we'll see.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, let's be honest, it's not often when we talk about insurers it's in a great light, and well, today is absolutely no different. So I want you to cast your mind back to 2016. On this very podcast, we spoke about plans by Admiral, if you remember, that would see them nosing around your social media account to decide the cost of your car insurance. Now, if you think that sounds Orwellian, it's because it is. A big backlash ensued, followed by an embarrassing climb down from Admiral just 2 hours, I believe, before the launch. Facebook deemed that it had breached its privacy rules. So surely no insurer does anything like that now. Simon?
No, and I wasn't quite sure how Admiral were going to do this. I mean, whether they were just going to search through your Facebook feed and see if you'd been posting drifting videos or say, putting out messages saying, I'll see you at the meet down at the retail park car park.
Were they using your language, though? Because they thought that they could tell by the way in which you spoke a certain way. So many extraordinary things.
It wasn't as obvious as you were posting old pictures from Max Power on your
Facebook or your smashed cars.
So this came about from a conversation that we had in the office. Would your insurer genuinely turn down your claim if you'd been burgled while you were on holiday because you'd been Instagramming your holiday and that was letting people know that you weren't at home? This is a common urban legend, I would say. Now, Will Kirkman, our reporter, did some digging into this and he said, no, that is not the case. Not that it would never, ever, ever happen, but it was not the case that insurers were doing this, going, okay, well, you got burgled while you were away, but you kept sharing those Instagram photos of you on the beach, and so the burglars knew that you were out. However, what they will do, potentially, is after you make a claim, they might go and have a little peek around the stuff that you were publicly posting to see whether you might be telling the truth. And this isn't going to be for everyone, but it certainly will be for those people whom they think might not be telling the truth. And I don't know whether people realise this. They should do. But when you phone your insurer and you make a claim, the insurers do actually have people who try to ascertain whether they think you're trying to defraud them and making this whole thing up. And common sense says that one of the things they will do to investigate you nowadays is take a look at your social media, what you're publishing on there. Now, what they won't do, for example, is try and falsely befriend you to try and get into what you're posting privately only to friends and family.
And preemptively do this either.
Nor preemptively do this or honey trap you or things like that. But what they will do is look at the stuff that you're publicly sharing and see whether that backs up the case that they've already put together in their heads. And people make dubious claims. My car was written off a few years back by someone who was a drunk driver. They smashed into the side of it. Their car went down the road. They had actually been vomiting out the window of the car when they smashed into it. The airbag went off. They got out of the car. They ran off down the road and abandoned the car. We had to make a claim. The person who owned the car maintained it was stolen. So it looked like we'd just been involved in a hit and run on our car. We're going to have to claim off our own insurance. But it was uncovered that it was not the case, by the person's own insurer who didn't believe them. Because when questioned on, this was on a Sunday night, I've had my car stolen. Mm. When was it stolen? Yesterday afternoon. Why are you only calling us now on the Monday morning? They didn't believe them.
Yeah. And did they test the vomit in the car as well?
Well, interestingly, it's very difficult to speak to the police about this, and I asked them about this. And I said, well, why? Surely this is easy to prove. You just, you know, DNA tested the vomit. And they said, well, we can't do that unless we think that they've committed a crime and there's a victim. And we didn't count as
You're
victims.
You're a victim, yeah.
No, we didn't count as victims. All it was right. One of those weird things where you don't count as a victim and they didn't suspect him of a crime. But anyway, it was his own insurer that caught him out.
We have this extraordinary situation, Sarah, don't we, where we think that what we post on social media is private. It's not, everybody. It is very public. And even when you try and hide it...
Yeah, you can get caught out. Yeah. I think people don't realise the impact it can potentially have. I mean, this goes beyond insurance as well. I mean, there's all sorts of questions about whether or not... I mean, they already use social media to catch people out who are committing fraud, posting their lavish lifestyles online when
employers
their income does not match.
Well. Yeah,
employers look at it. If you're applying for a mortgage and you say that you are going to take a residential mortgage, for example, and then you let the property out, that is illegal to do that unless you let your lender know and you genuinely took the mortgage on a residential basis because you did intend to live there and you need to live there for a while. However, lots and lots and lots of people have done that in the past, and I would think probably still do. There are investigations that go on to make sure that you're not committing that fraud. Yeah. And social media is yet another tool available to these companies to look into what you're saying and whether it matches what you're doing. So people do need to, well, first of all, not break the law, but second of all, think about what they're posting on social media, because it will influence how others perceive you.
Yeah, do. Not just your family and friends. All right, so after all those baddies, we do actually have some goodies today, especially if you're a petrol head, Simon. We are looking at saving money and quite literally saving cars from the crusher. But first, after a bumper month of big discounts on new cars in August, the good news is that you can still get some tidy savings on some of the most popular mainstream models if you are quick. Simon, what's going on?
Car makers are currently struggling to sell cars. There are a number of issues, one of which was suggested a while back by one of the dealers as that we'd hit peak new car, as in so many people have bought new cars that we had run out of people to buy new cars. Also, there is all of the stuff around diesel. People don't like buying diesel cars because they're worried about the fact that there's going to be extra taxes on them and they're going to lose their value. And that has been hitting car sales. So car makers are trying to shift cars in the only way that they know how, and that is with discounts.
So what are we talking about here, and what can you get?
We got some information from CarWow. CarWow is a website where you put in your details as to the car you want to buy, and then they punt it out to the dealers, and the dealers compete to offer you the best price. You might think that if you wanted to buy a Mercedes, for example, you just go into your local Mercedes dealership.
No, not
and
anymore.
All Mercedes dealerships will offer you the same discount because they are Mercedes. That is not true. You might find that the Mercedes dealership in the next town offers a better dealership than the Mercedes dealership in your town, because they're all independent businesses, ultimately, that are franchised to Mercedes and trying to maximise their sales. So, the cars that you can make the biggest savings on, the Mercedes GLE, medium-sized SUV, 4x4, saving £11,362. BMW X5, another 4x4, £9,649. Mercedes E-Class, big saloon, £9,079 on average. Mercedes GLC, smaller 4x4, £8,378. Note that a lot of the biggest savings here are on big cars that tended to be ones that were predominantly also sold with diesel engines, hence the fact they're struggling to shift them. But even things like the Nissan Qashqai, which Qashqai Man replaced Mondeo Man, it's a really popular car amongst the middle England buyer. You can get £5,000 off those on average, and that's a hefty saving.
That is not bad at all.
And these are all 6-8 plate cars. That's the other interesting thing going on here. We had the new number plate change, and normally that drives up sales, but people are so reticent that even that isn't really working, so you're getting big discounts.
Meanwhile, good news for those of you who hate seeing perfectly good cars crushed. So even if you don't like cars, I don't particularly like seeing them crushed. A scheme set up 10 years ago saved thousands of vehicles worth more than £500 million from the big scrapyard in the sky. Crushwatch, it's called. Even saved 9 Lamborghinis, good news for pensioners, obviously with the pension freedoms, from being crumpled last year. So Simon, what is going on here? Why would perfectly good cars be crushed, including Ferraris and Lamborghinis?
Because they're uninsured. They're found as uninsured. They're seized by police forces. So what's happening is that then if they can't get that person to pay up or bring them to book, the cars end up getting crushed. So they might get impounded. And then when they're impounded, there's fees for them being impounded. The people don't pay the fees for the car being impounded. What's the benefit?
Surely you could just sell the car and then pay the fees with the sale of the car, no?
Well, the key to Crushwatch is that in conjunction with a company, an organisation called HPI, which holds lots of vehicle data. And what they have managed to do is check illegally driven vehicles with HPI before disposing of them, which ultimately throws up the fact that lots of these have been bought on finance. So they're not actually technically owned by the person who is the registered keeper of the car. And that they have, instead of being crushed, been returned to finance companies. And I mean, astonishingly, among the list of cars saved from the crusher in the last decade are Aston Martins, Bentleys, Ferraris and Lamborghinis, all of which were caught on the road with an uninsured driver at the wheel. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? A car that's worth that much money and someone's skimping on the insurance. But I mean, the insurance would be expensive, but it seems mad. But then these cars aren't actually really owned by those people. They're paying a monthly amount. But last year alone, apparently a total of 9 Lamborghinis were saved from being crumpled.
What happens to the crushed car?
I mean,
who
crushes a Lamborghini?
No idea. I mean, unless it's used for the movies or something, you know, I cannot see. So, what? I mean, does it just go to like a big scrap heap? I mean, it just seems such waste.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, well, just crush it and it goes to scrap. Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
good.
You think that they'd break off the parts and sell it, or just sell it and give the money to charity or something, wouldn't you? Or sell it and give the money to the police force?
Yeah.
Watch. Yeah, but anyway, so they're being returned to the finance companies. The finance companies are then able to sell them on, and a perfectly good car is saved from being crushed, which ultimately is good for the environment.
That's what I was thinking.
There's an environmental cost to making new cars, as well as an environmental cost to driving cars.
Obviously.
Particularly Lamborghinis.
Well, there you go. Ending on a good note, thank you very much. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. If you have any comments to make about the podcast, or indeed any of the stories that you read on This Is Money, Simon?
Email us if you've got any questions or something you want us to investigate, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Come and see us on Twitter @thisismoney and join in the conversation, or also join in the conversation on the podcast articles published on This Is Money. And if you want to find all the old ones and the new ones, go to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.